What if the only thing standing up for your future was a half-drunk Nick Nolte? That's the terrifying world presented by Teachers, which was the number one movie in America.
The number one movie in America.
Movie in America.
Movie in America.
The number one movie in America.
It is the number one movie in America. I'm Sean Collier, and I'm here with two regular South Beach muscleheads. It's Camila Adams.
I didn't get Ralph Macchio.
Yeah. And Robin Hitchcock. Who didn't you get?
Robin Williams.
That would have been hard on several levels.
Yeah.
I contacted my medium and I was like, this movie made me keep thinking about Dead Poets Society. What do you have to say?
He just wasn't accepting calls.
Yep.
Still one of my favorite awards moments ever was when Shirley MacLaine got some Lifetime Achievement Award. Robin, do you know the one I'm talking about?
I don't.
It was like the Sidney Lumet Award. And she said, well, I'll be speaking with him later tonight.
Oh, gosh, that's great.
Because she's all, you know, mystical and whatnot.
Shirley.
Listen, we're going to go through the normal things. If you've watched Teachers, you know why this is what we have to start with. Why the hell did she take her clothes off at the end? What was that?
She was trying to make some sort of crazy point?
I really felt like I was maybe hallucinating. Have I cracked? Has quarantine broken me?
It was like, and I don't want to reveal too much about my own psyche, but it's like when you're having a sexy dream and the completely unrealistic sexy scenario that would only happen in a dream takes place.
Right.
There is no world in which, because 30 minutes ago Nick Nolte metaphorically said walk naked down the hallway, that this actual character in a movie is going to literally walk naked down a hallway, because that's not a thing that happens in any reality, even fictional realities.
No.
And yet the arguably the climax of this movie is a grown lawyer taking her clothes off in a high school.
This whole movie, I don't know, I like waver. I found it really hard to believe that Nick Nolte really gave a shit. You made the point at the top of the show about you know, the only thing that's gonna get you far in life is a half drunk Nick Nolte. Yes, this is true. Like, I don't understand why he is the hero, so to speak, in this film.
I think that was their intent, right? I think that they were like, who is the most like permanently hungover actor we could think of, because we want you to really feel like, oh, if this is the guy who cares, we're in trouble.
But it's not even that it's Nick Nolte. It's just I didn't see him do anything. Like, he tried to bully Ralph Macchio into taking the class again, and he took the underage student who was impregnated by her fucking gym teacher to go get an abortion. But, you know, and I just, without her parents' consent, but, you know, there was nothing in there that he actually did that I didn't see him like do any like real lessons or lesson planning or like really like sit down and have a good heart to heart with one of the kids I don't know.
Didn't you see? He was Teacher of the Year in 1974. There was a dusty device that
just
told
keep
you
it
that.
On his counter. Just keep it on his kitchen countertop.
And he's using it as a cutting board, is what I was led to believe.
That's actually kind of funny.
I don't know whether you watch Teachers or if this just sounds like an elaborate joke we're playing on you, the listener. All of this is the movie we're talking about. But for further context for those people, I believe it is Robin on the 60-second recap.
And I do have notes. This is going to be not entirely Robin style, just because this is so convoluted, I wanted to make sure that I hit the important things. So let me pull my notes up. Okay. And I am ready.
And go.
All right. So at JFK High in Columbus, Ohio, there's a bunch of white men teachers who are all burnt out. And burnt outest among them is Nick Nolte's character, Mr. Jarrell. And there is a lawsuit because a student graduated without knowing how to read. So his Mr. Jarrell's former student, Jo Beth Williams, is the lawyer on the case. He has sex with her and decides that he is going to be honest in his deposition and say that the school is bad at education. So the school district settles and she realizes that she was trying to make the school education better, but she's going to make it worse because she's taking away all of their money. Meanwhile, another teacher dies. A student gets shot by the cops in the hallway and is never mentioned again. Ralph Macchio has full Brando in the Wild One energy. Laura Dern needs an abortion. And Jo Beth Williams gets naked in the hallway. The end.
Perfect. 58 seconds.
Nice. Well done.
That covers most of it, right?
Oh, yeah. That's pretty much it.
There's also, I left out the subplot about the substitute teacher who shakes things up. But
who's actually an outpatient.
Right. He's an escape mental patient. I didn't realize that that was such an old trope. You know what I mean? I've never seen Goodbye, Mr. Chips. Is Mr. Chips a substitute teacher?
I've never seen it.
Okay. Just, I know that like the one teacher who cares is a trope. They actually literally called Nick Nolte Mr. Chips at some point.
Right.
But
right.
Yeah, it was very funny to me having them invert that trope that way as just a subplot.
Yeah, and barely a subplot. It was right. Just kind of like sprinkled in there. Like he had four scenes, maybe.
Right. And he dresses up as all these historical figures. Right.
A little on the nose to not just say an escaped mental patient could do a better job, but literally demonstrate it. This is a very demonstrative movie. And I'll tell you, I still kind of liked it.
I really liked it. My score is not going to be super high because I think that there's some really obvious things that are wrong with it, but I enjoyed watching it very much. And I think that especially when I keep in mind that like this was 1984 and there weren't, this probably ethics. Was a little bit more. Yeah. Well, yes. This probably was a little bit more groundbreaking. Like it certainly wasn't, but this whole idea of like, let's show a high school for what it really is, where like things are wrong and students are troubled, I think was probably much more interesting in 1984 than it seems to us, because that is how high school is typically portrayed now.
Well, right. And a frank, you know, abortion plotline at that time was very exceptional. You know, that's the old trope that, you know, you're not even allowed to say the word abortion on film and you know, these things are danced around and implied and have a movie in 1984 where someone is, you know, going to a clinic to get an abortion and is stated as such is kind of a big deal.
Did you notice that the building said free clinic in no less than three places?
Yes. I was like, is this the free clinic?
It's the free clinic.
Yeah, did, you know, this is, I was not yet born, you know, the rest of the panel was very young. Before the police recorded Don't Stand So Close to Me, did no one know you couldn't have sex with your high school students? Like, is that how the world learned this was a problem?
Like, I'm assuming so, because it's like, it wasn't even really a problem. Like, the dude brought it to his attention. He's like, you got three students pregnant. Why not go impregnate some other schools? Like that.
Let's get you to another school.
Right. It wasn't a problem that this was statutory rape. This is straight up. Why here? Why in this school? We can't have that here in this school. Go to another school.
And I think that they probably wouldn't care if she didn't get pregnant.
Right. It was. Yeah. Oh, God.
Even our hero, Nick Nolte, early in the movie, like, hey, do you remember Beverly Del Johnson or however what's her name?
I don't remember.
Jo Beth Williams.
Jo
lawyer lady.
What I said, Beverly Vel. I think I pulled the name Beverly out of nowhere and then went Reginald Vel Johnson from Die Hard.
I do enjoy that name, whatever it is. I feel like you should. That's a character in your next film.
The character's name is Lisa Hammond.
Who's Beverly? Is there a Beverly involved in this?
No. I think
maybe you just wanted Beverly D'Angelo to be.
Oh, yeah, involved. I watched Vacation last week. I mean, all right.
I confused Beverly D'Angelo and Joe Beth Williams. So I think that huh. It's like blonde mothers of the 80s.
I mean, you don't confuse them with the guy from Family Matters and Die Hard, which I just did. But nevertheless, when he first refers to her, like, do you remember her? He's like, oh, yeah, she had a great ass.
Yeah,
like,
right.
As a child, apparently.
And yeah.
A normal... That's so weird.
It's, you know, and I was even waiting for them to be like, and not that it would be any better, but for them to be like, these teachers teach seniors and these girls were 18. Like, that would have like taken like the edge off a pinch, just a pinch. But no, we also, like completely say they're 16.
It's okay. So it's one of those things when I was in high school and we had some creepy teachers, every high school had creepy teachers. Yeah, I remember thinking like, well, they're like 25. We're not that much younger than them. And then I turned 25 and I was like, oh no, it is super creepy to be interested in a 16-year-old at this age.
Exactly. And it's funny how, you know, you look at it on the flip-flop side. Like, right. When you're 16, it's like, oh my God, we can totally date. You're only 25. But then when you're 25, there's no way in fuck you would want anything to do with a 16-year-old.
Also,
hopefully.
Like, Nick Nolte's not 25 in this movie.
Right.
But,
oh.
And I'm Yeah, and so, yeah, she was his former student. And I still find it weird and creepy that he had sex with her as a former student.
Fully, it's so weird. I don't, and when she's like, I used to have a crush on you, I'm like, ugh. Yeah, it's gross. And also, like, kind of unethical.
Yeah.
But between this and Jagged Edge, we should be adding gross legal incompetence as a square on the bingo board.
Seriously.
Because
it's less upsetting when it's not your client, but it's still very bad.
Yes.
But he's the enemy of her work, right?
Not necessarily, right? Like, she That's does true. Lure him into honest testimony with her sweet, sweet vagina.
That is entirely true. I also had trouble accepting Nick Nolte cast as a pickup artist, like a successful pickup artist. Like, yes.
Really?
He managed to score this, you know, reasonably lovely lady for the night.
Nick Nolte's super sexy.
Really?
What?
Yeah.
What?
What?
Oh my God! Wow!
Like, not Nick Nolte 2020. He's no, like a raisin. Still,
I was still even looking at Nick Nolte in 1984. Like, is this man supposed? Was he attractive? Because I don't see it.
He is to me.
He's not my cup of tea.
Like, his face is okay. I definitely have a thing for that hair. That's like, I wish that hairstyle would come back. That's like my ideal hair on a man. And listen, and then also, like, like you said, like, pickup artists, like, there's other movies too where Nick Nolte, like, tries to be. Have you ever seen Afterglow?
Mm-mm.
It's a terrible movie, but Nick Nolte is like a handyman who sleeps with all of his clients. He shows up, fixes your house, and then has sex with you. And he's so sexy in it. And that's, you know,
drilling some holes
for this. Yes, exactly. So 15 years younger with the perfect haircut doing the same thing. I'm all about it. Huh. Anyway, that's the window into my psyche.
I've learned a lot about Robin today.
He was great in The Mandalorian, not his sexiest role. He was some kind of a small elf creature. But hey, there's someone who's into that too.
Yeah. There's something for everyone. We got some stats on this blockbuster.
Yeah, I mean, we're going back, so this
how
is where...
did it happen? That's
right,
my question.
Yeah, I'm just wondering. I mean, was it a very, very, was this like in the middle of summer, very slow?
Well, we should acknowledge this is after the charts are allegedly complete, but having looked at them, they're real weird. Teachers was definitely the number one movie in America at some point. A lot of this information is sketchy, but I'm confident that it was number one. Here's what we have. Go ahead, Mila.
I was just going to say it was like released in August in a heat wave where nobody had air conditioning.
We need something. But that's what doesn't make sense. The number of things in theaters this week, the weekends it was out, including the likes of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Ghostbusters, Karate Kid, Terminator came out during this run. This was all out there. So wow. I think there are things about the way movies were marketed in the early to mid 80s that we are lost to us. Mm-hmm. In any case, October 5th, 1984, Teachers was released. It was the 17th number one film of that year. It won the Columbus Day Long Weekend with $7 million. Also debuting that weekend, Irreconcilable Differences with Tiny Drew Barrymore. Aww. That was in fourth with $2.7 million. Teen movie The Wildlife, written by a very young Cameron Crowe, debuted in fifth with $2.2 million. So these results from the early 80s are screwy. It was definitely number one in its first weekend. I can't confirm its second weekend. Wikipedia says The Teachers was still number one. Wikipedia says The Teachers won three straight weekends. I know. And what's definite is it won its third weekend. The second weekend is the weird one. The new wonky box office mojo says there was this bizarre late surge by Temple of Doom, which also happened to win that weekend. It might have been like, this is the last chance to see it in theaters. One of those marketing tricks, because it
used to matter more.
Right. Temple of Doom was gone after that weekend. So maybe it beat Teachers in that weekend. Temple of Doom is listed as winning the following weekend with $6.1 million. Teachers had 4.5. Teachers definitely won its third weekend with 3.4 million. It was out of the top by the fourth weekend, which is another screwy one records-wise. But it is absolutely true that Terminator came out that weekend and made more money than the fourth weekend of Teachers, as you would assume. The point is, Teachers is at least a two-week and maybe a three-week number one. It made $27.7 million overall, the 29th highest grossing film of 1984. The top three of that year went Ghostbusters, Temple of Doom, and Gremlins. Obviously, no Oscar nominations for Teachers, but the film was directed by Arthur Hiller. Robin, the big Academy connection?
You want me to talk about Arthur Hiller? I could talk about Arthur Hiller for days. I don't know what his big Academy Award movie is. The one that I thought about a lot was The Hospital, which won Paddy Chayefsky Screenwriting Award, which is basically Teachers, but it's a hospital.
Huh. Right.
And George C. Scott was also nominated for Best Actor. That's why I watched it as part of my quest to watch all the Oscar-nominated performances since 1970. And it's a great movie. And George C. Scott got nominated the year after he refused his win for Patton. So he's that good in it that the Academy was like, okay, jerk.
Do you have a list of all of these movies and stuff that you have to watch?
I have a very detailed spreadsheet.
Or is this just like, I would prefer it if it was just like a giant piece of paper, like on your wall when you're just like random.
At one point, I did print out all the movies that were left in order of how many nominations were in them so that when I would go to the exchange, I could just walk through and be like, does anybody have doubt it has four nominations that I've never seen it? I have now seen it.
Pretty good.
So what is the movie you were thinking of, Sean?
Well, the biggest connection between Arthur Hiller and the Oscars was that Arthur Hiller was the president of the Academy from 93 to 97.
Oh, I did not know that.
He was a prolific director. He directed more than 30 movies that were kind of all over the place. A lot of comedies. He did Silver Streak, The Out-of-Towners, Outrageous Fortune. He did the Man of La Mancha adaptation. Go ahead.
Burn Hollywood Burn.
And Burn Hollywood Burn.
An Alan Smithy film.
His only Oscar nomination, of course, was for Love Story. By the way, slight aside, I saw that for the first time a couple of months ago, Love Story.
So did I.
With Ryan, whatever?
Ryan O'Neill.
Yeah.
And Ally McGraw.
Not good. It's just not a good movie.
All right.
I'm
going to disagree with you there, Sean.
I showed that for a heckle-a-thon evening at the Hollywood Theater. So
you also don't think it's good?
Yeah.
Okay. Listen, I love people. I saw Before Sunrise when I was probably first starting to like boys. Mm-hmm. All right. It was like, to me, the greatest movie I had ever seen. And any movie that's like two people who love each other having a lot of conversations, I'm into it.
Oh, okay.
It certainly has that. it also, like, just the whole, the conflict of that movie is that she's dying and it arrives with 12 minutes to go.
It is it's very weird because she has no symptoms. Yeah. She's just alive and then she's dead. Or she's briefly in a hospital and then she's dead.
she's basically dying of dramatic poignance.
So it's not good. I just enjoyed it very much. Let's put it.
No,
that way.
It's
that's fair.
And I understand why it was a cultural phenomenon.
Yes, it's likable because those two are have a great chemistry and are very likable together. And you can imagine being a Harvard educated romantic in the old times, but
right. Also, she's a manic pixie dream girl.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So, right. I like that she keeps calling him preppy even as she's dying. That's nice. Love story aside, what else do I have? Teachers is the only credit for the screenwriter W.R. McKinney.
It has to be a pseudonym.
It's the only credit of any kind. Like, if you go to his IMDb, he's not, you know, it's not like additional help, you know, he never existed other than this. I can't find anyone saying it was a pseudonym. I can't find, like, you know, anyone even opining that he doesn't exist. There's just no information in the world about
that. That is crazy.
Yeah, I mean, somebody has to call Nick Nolte. Robin can have a loaded conversation with Nick Nolte and ask about W.R. McKinney.
Let's start an urban legend about who W.R. McKinney is.
I think it might be one of the people who made my so-called life, because there are several scenes in this movie that later appeared in my so-called life.
I mean, after Crimson Tide, I'm just going to assume it's Quentin Tarantino. Like, how old then? Like 19 and stretching his wings?
Right.
And finally, three songs from the soundtrack of Teachers made it to the Billboard Hot 100. Joe Cocker's Edge of a Dream, which was played somewhere in the middle.
It's played the first time he's on a date with Jo Beth Williams. And it's also played at the end after she gets naked and convinces him to be a good person.
Right. That peaked at number 69.
Because I'm 12.
The main title theme, Teacher, Teacher, by 38 Special, was number 25 on the charts. Bob Seger's Understanding, which plays over the beginning of the end credits, hit number 17, the highest ranking Teacher song. That was the only one where I was like, oh, I think I've heard this before.
Hot for Teacher wasn't released at this point?
Oh, that's a couple of years later. But it's Hot for Teacher is simultaneously Van Halen's best and worst song.
I don't know if you noticed that at the end of the movie, it's like, instead of where it should say directed by Arthur Hiller, it's like soundtrack produced by.
So weird.
Yeah. It's like, clearly they were like, ah, this is the asset. This is what we'll make the money on.
Right.
I think that that more people knew this, more people who were around at the time knew this by the music than by having seen the movie.
Hot for Teacher was released in October of 84.
Ah, it was a big moment for teachers having sex with students.
Clearly.
I was going to say, friend of the podcast, Ben Mayer, said, I've heard of this movie and I can still sing the theme song.
Yeah.
Right. I was shocked and in awe about the amount of people there were like two or whatever that chimed in, but that there was anybody who knew what this was and saw it in the theater, I think somebody mentioned. So, yeah. I mean,
right.
I do love really generic 80s soundtrack rock. That is a,
Me too.
Camila, if you run out of playlist ideas, I want songs from movies in the 80s that I've never heard of before, but are identifiably definitely from a movie in the 80s.
That's a really long title, but okay.
Yeah. You know, punch up the name a little bit.
I'm so confused by how this movie was number one, but Karate Kid wasn't in the same year.
Agreed.
True?
Yeah, it's like Karate Kid is not on the list of, like, Karate Kid 2 and 3 are, but 1 did not make the cut.
Well, I would say prior to the 90s, the records do get screwy, but that seems really off, unless Karate Kid kind of was a sleeper thing that, you know, people gained a lot of
Karate Kid was a hit. I think that maybe it was one of those things where it's a hit, but it came out in the summer, and so it wasn't making as much money as maybe Temple of Doom.
Right, that's probably.
Yeah, it did not. It actually increased in theaters, so like it added theaters as it went. There must not have been a lot of buzz its first weekend because it opened in sixth. Okay, now it makes more sense. It opened in sixth because the top three were Ghostbusters, Gremlins, and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Oh, Yeah.
Followed by Breakin, followed by Rhinestone, which beat Karate Kid in both of their first weekend. So Karate Kid was just crowded, and it hung around. It rose to fourth a bunch of different times, but yeah, it never went to number one.
That's crazy pants.
Breakin was number one the weekend I was born.
Ah.
Or I was born on the Monday after the weekend that Breakin was number one.
Oh, I don't know what was number one the weekend I was born, and that's something I should know.
Be careful, though, because one of the websites that does that for you told me that my answer was The Natural, but then when I went into Box Office Mojo back in the before times when that was still a website that was functional, it said that that was the weekend after.
I'm going to find out right now because I need to know.
I saw an ad the day I was born. It would say the number one movie in America, Breakin.
I like it. That's pretty sweet.
A friend for many, many years.
That's right. I knew this. Taxi Driver.
Wow.
My friend of many years, Sean Israel. Do either of you know Sean?
I do know Sean.
He's you know, a figure in Pittsburgh circles in a million different ways. And for a long time was a radio DJ. He was on, I know when I was a kid, he was on what was then Variety 96. His remarkable party trick is if you walk up to him and tell him your birth date, he can, from memory, tell you what the number one song in America was the day you were born.
Wow.
Because he was a radio DJ for a long time when there was like basically no one else in the studio and a lot of downtime, and he spent that time memorizing the Billboard number ones.
That's insane.
I think mine is Against All Odds by Phil Collins.
I think mine was Do You Know the Theme from Mahogany, or it was the theme from Shaft. I forget which one it was.
Careless Whisper. Very, very happy about that. as I am with my birthday number one movie, which turns out to be Beverly Hills Cop.
All right.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Teachers is weird. I liked it. I think I mostly liked it because everyone is acting the shit out of it. Like, Nick Nolte is actually very, very good. Judd Hirsch is good. I loved little tiny Laura Dern very early in her career. She was great. And Ralph Macchio, I mean, now that he's not on the show, it's not like Ralph Macchio is a great actor, but like,
He brings it, though.
But he does.
He was trying so, like I said, he was bringing his Brando, and like, I was impressed.
But I think up until this point, like, he's kind of basically had, he was kind of typecast, because it's not like he had a lot in his filmography before this, but he was always playing that troubled, until Karate Kid, really, that troubled teen. So like, what was it, Eight is Enough? He was on that show, and I think he was like a foster kid or an adoptive kid or something like that, adopted kid, and he had some troubles. And then after that, it was like The Outsiders, where he was like getting beat at home, and you know Johnny, and there was something else too. But yeah, he kind of had that thing about him at that point, where he was just always this troubled kid.
Crispin Glover too.
God.
So, I mean,
I don't know if I would have recognized him.
That's the youngest I've ever seen him, and that's like counting like Back to the Future and now. He looks basically the same, but like
a lot happened between this and Back to the Future. Apparently,
he went from degenerate to iconic nerd in the space of a year.
Right.
Yeah, that plot line though, he caught it in Robin's recap. He's like the most troubled of the troubled kids in a plot line that's completely underwritten to the point of not being written. Right. I don't know why he hated that one teacher.
I don't know if it was
the one there
was. Yeah. I don't even know if it was like if it was personal to that teacher. It just could have been that it was like he's PTSD. Like maybe he's getting abused at home and he just had this is his reaction to being touched on, you know, unsolicited. I understand what they were trying, the point they were trying to make with this movie, but I feel like it was kind of done in a very disjointed and clunky way. There were this whole plot line with Crispin Glover's character. That should have been could have been fleshed out a little bit more, and not even so to the point where it would take over what this film was about. Because you're right, like Robin said, it's never mentioned again. Like, you know, Ralph Macchio, he cries about it for a little bit, and then nobody else really addresses the fact that a kid was shot in the hall.
It's unclear to me how much time has passed after it, because it's like that happens, and then there's a fully unrelated scene,
right?
And then they come back and Ralph Macchio's sad. So I'm like, is it later that day? Is it three months later? Like, I feel like if a kid got shot by the cops in a high school, the school would be closed for at least a week.
Yeah.
But maybe that's a, you know, a millennial attitude. So I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe that wasn't the thing in 84. Like, it's just, right, they were like, oh, they went back to class right after it happened. Like, somebody's just like mopping up the blood and, you know, they're like, get back to class.
Is this realistic or not? Like, I went to a big high school. The office did not look like a police bullpen. Like, like, I can't tell if this is like way over the top or if this is like vaguely in the realm of plausible for the.
Yeah,
it's shot I went to high school building. Yeah,
I went to private Catholic school, so I have no idea.
So, Camille, you're from Ohio, right?
Yeah, and you know, and thank you for pointing out where I was from, because I was confused. I assumed it was Michigan because of all the snow.
I don't know if they make it clear in the movie that it's in Columbus, but it says in like on like the IMDb page, it says that the school is the Columbus school. And then it was filmed in this building in Columbus, which used to be a high school. And now it is the Center for Science and Industry in Columbus, which is something COSI is something. I talked to my friend Evie, who used to live in Columbus, Ohio, just about like, hey, what is Columbus like? Because I was specifically, maybe we should save this for the bingo card, but I specifically wanted to know if we were going to have to check off whitewashed. And her answer was yes, yes, we do. So maybe we'll have to revisit that once we get to that segment. But yeah.
I mean, I don't know what, I don't think I've ever, I may have been to Columbus once, and that was probably like 5 or 6 years ago. But Toledo, which is much further north where I'm from, my school, like I said, I went to private Catholic, and it was probably like 15% black students there. So, you know, we all knew each other, and I don't know if that was just because it was private Catholic school or what, because, you know, like I said, I don't have much. That's why I went. That was my entire school career was private Catholic. So I don't know anything about public school so much. And like there was another like really small school that I had gone to in like seventh grade, and they were like literally it was probably like I want to say maybe 300 students total, then there were probably 5 black kids, and we were all related to each other, so that was
well,
so that's kind of
like they do have black students at the school, they just don't get speaking roles, you know what I mean? It's
not really,
one of those things. And then the same thing with I've literally never seen so many white male teachers in one depiction of a high school. And I knew that there used to be more male teachers and that it's become like an increasingly gendered profession. But I went and looked it up, and the closest I could get to was 1987, where 67% of teachers were female. And in this movie, they've got the one teacher who has her gun stolen, and they've got the one teacher who says, maybe people should have more experience before they speak, which is my favorite part of the whole movie.
I know it. I love that.
I want that as my ringtone. What is that actress's name? I just saw her in something else. She's so great.
She was like really big in like the late 80s and 90s. She used to play a professor on A Different World too.
Oh, okay. All right. I think that's what I generally recognize her from.
Right. Yeah.
But that line was amazing.
We should at the very least acknowledge the presence of Morgan Freeman when he was only in middle age.
He still looked. He still looks the same.
He looked the same. It was 36 years ago.
Morgan Freeman has never been young.
this was the shock of realizing how old Morgan Freeman actually is, because my note was he already looks 53, which wasn't far off. He's like 46, 47. Like Morgan Freeman was born in 1937.
Whoa. Damn. So he's 83.
Morgan Freeman is 83 years old.
Wow.
Mary Alice. Yes.
He was there, and it was weird that you're seeing all of these people who look so much younger than you picture him, and Morgan Freeman, who, you know, looks a good 5 to 6 years younger than he is today.
With that glorious perm.
His hair is amazing. All the hair in this movie is amazing.
Oh, I want to start a Tumblr of teachers' fashions, because it's all great. Like,
I wrote down in my notes that the shoulder pads that Joe Beth Williams I wrote down those shoulder pads could fight a world war.
This is absolute truth, because she looks like somebody just placed an upside down triangle on her. And it was just like, go on, go forth and act, Joe Beth. Go forth and act.
Well, we started with unnecessary full nudity and ended with shoulder pads. I think that makes it time to rate it. I have no idea what's going to happen, so let's just go across the screen. Camila?
Where did I put it? 63.
63 from Camila. Robin?
76.
76. That's higher than I anticipated.
I thought it was a good movie. It's got problems. Naked in the hallway problems.
Yeah. Man, I thought that brief nudity in the pickup scene at the beginning was like throwing a bone to the audience. Yeah, you bought a ticket. Here are some boobs.
Here's some boobies.
And then we're done. No, we are not done.
I thought it was we want an R rating so people take this movie seriously even though children are in it. Boob exposure.
I just thought it was just random 84 boobs. That's what we got. We got a lot of just random naked boobs in the 80s.
Also, I bet that's why Ben remembers this movie exists.
Ah.
Oh, here is a brief preview of You Can't Handle the Truth before we finish rating, because we're talking about 80s boobs. I just watched Friday the 13th Part 2. Mm-hmm. And there's this one character where, like, they're clearly setting up, like, hang around, she's going to be naked. And it didn't happen. And I'm like, well, why wasn't there... So, turns out, this girl had lied about her age to be in the movie, was not 18. They filmed a full nudity scene. Later, she was celebrating her birthday on set and celebrating the fact that she was turning 18, having forgotten that she had lied about her age. So, they deleted all of the footage of her naked. And she went on to have a short career and I think now is in jail for passing bad checks. It was a trip.
So let me ask you this. Did you find this all out because you were like asking Google, hey, Google, why was this broad not naked when she was supposed to be naked in Friday the 13th Part 2? where did you come up with this story?
If that's one poll and just general Friday the 13th research is one poll, it's somewhere in the middle. Like, usually at the end of anything I watch, I'm like poking around the IMDb and the Wikipedia, but with a specific mind to who was this chick and what was the deal.
Gotcha.
I won't. I mean, you'll figure it out if you know Friday the 13th Part 2. I won't use her name because it does seem like she had a brief film career. She was in a couple horror movies. She backed away. She said in an interview I read that she worked for Death Row Records. Probably not ever true. And then later was in and out of jail and living in an abandoned warehouse. It's
wow.
All of which precedes my rating for Teachers. It's an organized podcast. For
I am looking forward to her memoir.
I give it a 67, so very, very... We're all about on the same page here.
Yeah.
Final score is a 68, 68 and two-thirds. So, you know, we liked it well enough. That's what that rating means. On the big chart, that puts it... smack in the middle. But with the exact same rating as Ready Player One. Teachers is exactly as good of a movie.
Interesting.
As Ready Player One.
Which was artificially lifted by your rating, if I remember correctly.
Yes, it absolutely was. Yeah. The book's good. I mean, it's not, but it is. So, we've got new bingo cards. Before we go to the new bingo cards, what is the prize? Here's my pitch. I think Robin already got a second veto, so she can't get more.
Right.
Camila, if you or I win, we get a second veto.
Okay.
If Robin wins again, mm-hmm. We have to escalate and Robin just gets to pick a movie.
Yeah, that's what I've... Just a movie off the list or just a movie... Just a.
It's got to be a number one movie in America.
Okay. But... All right, I like it.
All right.
I like it too.
You and I are playing for veto power. Robin is playing for... Ultimate
all the power.
God-like power. Yeah.
So, on the new bingo cards.
And by just
the way,
to be clear,
if we did get to pick, I might, I might have picked Speed. So,
yeah.
I haven't looked at the full list.
Right. So, before we, I wanted to clear, when I put whitewash down, I didn't necessarily mean, like, what you're talking about with this film. Just more or less, like, Tom Cruise in The Last Samurai.
Right.
Or, you know, stuff like
Scarlett
that.
Johansson most of the time.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Right.
So then we certainly get one word title.
Right.
It's not quite one location. I think we certainly get Before They Were Famous, right?
I would agree. Yeah. My Absolutely. Only counterpoint there is that Laura Dern had been Miss Golden Globe before this.
No.
Okay.
Considering, I don't even know what that is.
Miss Golden Globe is every year at the Golden Globes, the daughter and recently son or daughter of a famous person gets to stand there and wave. And that was Laura Dern at one point.
Oh, no.
All right. Check off Before They Were Famous and one word title on your bingo cards. I think that's it. We're not
Wait,
counting
just
this.
To be, just to be clear about bingo, it's not diagonal. It doesn't bingo. You, bingo is only horizontal and vertical, right?
No, you could go diagonal.
Okay.
Why, did you have a bingo last time and didn't tell us because of a misunderstanding of the bingo rules?
No.
Okay.
But I'm like two away, if that's the case now.
Oh, wow.
Me How too.
Ah.
Sorry. Yeah, if I'm we... original that has a remake and sports movie away.
Okay. I'm so, like, the ratings differ and a couple breaks up.
So in other words, if we land on Bad News Bears, you're going straight to a win
right?
for the second episode. We have another segment this week. In here, before we get to You Can't Handle the Truth, we want to introduce a longtime colleague of mine, the website Box Office Profits, that's profits with a P-H, boxofficeprofits.com, is a movie culture and especially box office tracking website that has been around since the 1990s. I have been contributing on and off since, let's see, since I got out of college. So I think I first started writing there in 2008. Done a number of different things for them over the years. The editor, David Mumpower, graciously offered to come on and talk about the unprecedented box office times we are living in that there's no box office. So we will now take you to a brief conversation with my editor and friend, David Mumpower of Box Office Profits. David, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being with us today.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, after running Box Office Profits for how long? More than 20 years, correct?
July of 2001. But we did a previous box office site that goes back to 1998. So, yeah, more than 20 years.
What was it like a couple of weeks ago to, you know, arrive on Monday morning and have no box office results?
I think the old person's equivalent would be for the newspaper to not show up in the morning and then never show up again.
Yeah.
Look, we've talked about something on BOP for so long now that people either think we're alarmist or realist, depending on whether they agree with us. And the subject matter is movie ticket sales have been in decline since the 1940s, okay? So this isn't like a shocking thing. It's been a gradual erosion for the most part. But it's like if 10 dinosaurs died one day and then every single dinosaur suddenly died the following day. You yeah. can't possibly accept that sort of cataclysmic change in your head. It's just something that until it happens, it doesn't seem real.
Yeah. And what, you know, this is the big question, and it's a lot of speculation. You know, at some point this year, theaters are going to open up again. What do you think the biggest difference in that world is going to be?
There is a real chance, and we're all having to accept this, that the movie industry never truly recovers this, at least in the form that we're used to knowing it. I mean, we're joking. March 11th, that's the 9/11 of this generation. And any day before that was before. And so, you know, as recently as December, you're at the movie theater is absolutely packed. If you went to see Bad Boys for Life, the movie theater was packed. Packed movie theaters aren't necessarily something you should expect in the next calendar year of your life. Now, it's possible, but I don't take that for granted anymore because people are now aware of things that they should have been all along, but they never really thought about because it was too depressing. They know that someone's germs can do something to them that's scary. And so when I talk to movie executives, they're freaked. I mean, there's just no getting around that. I had one who said something genuinely chilling to me, and he's not somebody who's scared as a rule. He said, there's a chance we've released our last film ever in theaters as far as a blockbuster. Yeah. And that person has tentpole projects in the pipe right now. They just don't know. So when you're asking me what to expect, I don't think anybody really knows. I think that the days of sitting next to someone in a movie theater aren't gone, but maybe they should be. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's I know that in a lot of things, it's hard to imagine what's going to come next, but it's I think this is an industry uniquely affected by the new reality.
Exactly.
Well, I work in live theater, and so which is even more affected.
Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I refuse to, as someone who works in live theater and absolutely loves the experience of going to the movies and laughing with strangers, this is devastating. But the one, like,
I'm sorry, I kind of wish she warned me about that. Didn't mean to bring you down during an already bad time.
Trust me, I know. I know. But what I was going to say is that, like, this weird silver lining that I've seen is that, you know, obviously I've been worried about movie theaters going away, like you said, since the 1940s. I haven't been alive that long, but I've been aware of the fact that it's sort of this dying experience. And in a way, I like the idea of it not just fading away. Do you know what I mean? It not just being this like thing that people just forget ever existed, like a radio drama, and it being more of a, hey, what can you do? Act of God. Right?
Yeah, I mean, it's the bang versus the whimper, you know? Would you rather die slowly, gruelingly of cancer? Or would you rather have, what was it, The Unbearable Being of Light? What was the name of that film? Anyway, thank you. One of the scenes in that is, you realize these people were happy the day that they died in a car wreck. Is that better or worse than living a full, long life? And that's kind of what we're at with a lot of businesses right now. I mean, at least you have an excuse now. You can always say, it wasn't us, it was the coronavirus, and maybe that's better. But live theater is actually an interesting analogy, because what I've been telling people is that I believe that movie theaters are going to move the way the concerts have. All concerts used to be, you know, $20, and now concerts are $200. And what happened was, it became an experiential thing where people were willing to pay more for something that they admire. And we've already started to see theaters testing these boundaries with things like 4DX and 270-degree screens. I don't know how familiar you are with either of these things.
I'm aware that they exist.
Okay. 4DX is, like, weird. We went and saw John Wick 3, and our seats would shake every time there was a bullet fired. And you don't realize how much bullet fire there is in that film until you're just the whole film. And so these are the types of things they're trying. Like, we watched Ford versus Ferrari in a 270-degree theater. So there's monitors on both sides, and it's kind of like playing a video game. It didn't work especially well, but, you know, with some augmented reality and some other things, possibly they can create a new cinematic experience that elevates it enough that people would pay $50 for date night instead of, you know, current pricing.
David, I wonder, right before the shutdowns began, a theater very close to me closed, and they kind of, you know, they blamed the factors that were in place before COVID. You know, they said Netflix and changing habits. But my reaction to that was, this also happened to be the crappiest movie theater in town. You know, this was the one with bad seats, bad picture, and bad popcorn. Now I see that, you know, the first chain that we're seeing, you know, there's real doubt about coming out of coronavirus is AMC. While I've been to some good AMCs, I've also been to a lot that were not really putting in a lot of effort. Could it be that the Alamo Drafthouses of the world and some of the places that are a little bit more focused on the customer experience are able to pull themselves out of this, whereas, you know, for lack of a better term, the fast food chains of the movie theater industry are the ones that can't rebound?
That's exactly where my thought process is when I'm saying it should grow more experiential. I've actually had people just panic asking me, is my movie theater ever coming back? And I don't want to be a buzzkill. I think that there is a chance that we will see consolidation in the industry, and that somebody will realize AMC can't meet its financial obligations, purchase it, consolidate, and try to keep the business model alive. However, I think that the reality is, a lot of businesses, I mean, every business, is now going to look at, what do we actually need versus what were we trying in the past? And when you look at what you need, that's 30% of movie theaters that maybe get killed out of this. And so the Alamo Drafthouse is the perfect analogy, the perfect blueprint prototype for what should happen next, which is doing something that makes people feel like they're not going to a movie, they're going out on the town for the night. And that's what people really want. And One of the reasons Disney fought so hard to keep the Black Widow release date on May 1st is because there is a belief that the instant people can safely go out of their houses, a lot of them, I don't know if it's smart or not, but a lot of them will rush to movie theaters saying, thank God I've missed this so much, it's not the same at home. I don't personally believe that's what's going to happen, but that is the underlying thought process.
Is it, is there a chance that this is bad for the mid-level movie, that you know, you will make a special trip to see Black Widow and you'll make a special trip to see Fast and the Furious next year, but for those reasons that you just explained, you're not going to bother going to a physical place anymore to see a Bloodshot?
Correct. I just read an interview with Bob Iger, who was just CEO of Disney until 2 days before the pandemic broke, coincidentally enough. And he's discussing Disney's movie release schedule. And he's point blank told Barons, we're going to keep the tentpole releases in theaters. He didn't have plans for Antlers. He didn't have plans for New Mutants. And Artemis Fowl, which was a $125 million production that I was personally excited for, is going straight to Disney Plus. So obviously some of these films they're not sure about have already fallen through the cracks. And I guess Onward was actually the first sign that was about to happen.
Artemis Fowl, I've been saying that that movie will never be released since, when was it supposed to come out? 2018?
So there have been delays. It's another one of those. It could be the next Harry Potter project films, none of which became the next Harry Potter project. I remember a Warner Brothers vice president yelled and screamed at me over what I said about Percy Jackson, and neither of the Percy Jackson films made any money, and those were what were successful by those standards. There are a bunch more. There just can't be another Harry Potter like that, and people are stubborn. But yeah, they're nine figures in on Artemis Fowl. They were just about to ramp up their marketing tie-ins and whatnot, and now it's going to go straight to Disney Plus.
David, thank you again for being with us. And before we let you go, since we're in the middle of the episode, this week we are discussing the 1984 drama Teachers. What can you tell us about Teachers?
I have seen the film. It used to be a lot on the movie channel back in the day. And honestly, the main thing I remember from it was that stupid 38 special song. So not much. Was it Jo Beth Williams? Am I remembering that correctly?
You are.
Okay.
Yeah, she had an awkward nude scene in the hallway.
Well, I didn't remember that, but okay, I'll take your word for it there.
Before we let you go, what do you have to tell people, to point people to beyond the site, of course, boxofficeprofits.com. But I know you have another Disney World book out recently as well.
Sure, you can read any of my Disney books. I've written three so far. There's Disney Demystified Volume 1, which is all about the history of Disneyland, starting with the opening day debacle in 1955, when 90 million people watched Disney, and they didn't have water in the building, and the pavements were not dried. You can follow that up with Disney Demystified Part 2, which takes place at Walt Disney World. One of the chapters in that was the FBI was convinced that the Russians were going to use Orlando, Florida as their infiltration point to invade the country. There were millions of dollars spent on this, and it turned out the Chinese guy they were worried about actually defected from China because he loved capitalism so much. That's the guy they were worried about. Behind the ride is just showing how Disney built all of its favorite classic rides. Yeah, I could write about a lot of stuff, but honestly, Disney had, until recently, been a happy subject, and so I'd prioritized it.
Oh, absolutely. I just want the world to get moving again by October so I can go down for Horror Nights and get on the Rise of the Resistance ride. Until then, thanks again for being here.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure meeting you, Sean. It's always a pleasure. Thank you for everything you've done over the years.
And we're back. Make sure you go to boxofficeprofits.com. I'm posting more there right now, given our current circumstances, and doing lots of great content, given that there's no box office to cover. Robin, the first thing I did for them on a regular basis was a thing called the A-List, which was basically, it was just a listicle article, like, here's a bunch of things on a very specific topic. One of the first things I ever wrote for them, you know, in the late aughts, was The Best of Charlize Theron.
Fantastic. Theron.
The best of Charlize Theron. So I like rented a bunch of Charlize movies on Netflix to try to figure out which the best ones were, preceding your podcast by quite some time. But don't worry, you did it well. I just rented some stuff.
Well, I'm glad you got to appreciate her career.
Man, I know how to pronounce her name, and I have chastised other people for not, and yet I still get it wrong sometimes.
I mean, it's a made-up pronunciation, so I can't be that obnoxious about it. It's like your made-up pronunciation is different than her made-up pronunciation.
Well, it's like you want to think that it's much more fancy than what it actually is. Like, that's the same thing I do with Angela Bassett. Like, I want to call her Angela Bassett, but it's like, it's just Bassett. So, yeah. So Theron.
Gal Gadot, we often say Gal Gadot.
Right.
Like she's a French lady.
Exactly.
It's time for You Can't Handle the Truth. What's everybody watching in their homes?
I finally watched The Invisible Man.
Yay, it happened.
We've talked about this every week since the shutdown began. I finally watched it. Yes, I loved it. It was great.
All right. Yeah, I'm happy your viewing was an enjoyment.
It's scary and good, and Elizabeth Moss is amazing.
Yes. I watched The Gentlemen.
How was that?
Yeah.
Ugh. He really could have kept that to himself. Like, like the one teeny tiny shiny moment of the movie. Like, I give Colin Farrell all the props for like his small role. He's probably only in like maybe 25% of the movie, but he's great in it, and it like makes it much more interesting. And I just kept waiting for something to really happen. I kept waiting for that moment where, and I know this is kind of a spoiler, but like Charlie Hunnam's character is like really reserved and just like really like calm and controlled of his life. And I was just waiting for, as per like usual with most Guy Ritchie films, for that dude to like find something happens and he loses his shit and he just goes all ape shit on somebody and like beats the fuck out of him in the streets. That's what I was waiting for, and it never fucking happened. I'm so upset about it. So
I was waiting for Nick Nolte to punch someone in Teachers. I thought he was going to punch the teacher who got Laura Dern pregnant. I thought he was going to punch Ralph Macchio's dad. Yeah, he never did. So I understand your frustration.
Yeah. So basically, I would leave it alone, man. Don't even bother.
At one point, you expressed that you wanted to see it, and I didn't want to be discouraging. Like,
you should have been, because I bought the damn thing. So now I
know.
There's going to be a lot of movies that people own that it's like, look, we were stuck in our house. Like,
why do I own Bloodshot? Oh, yeah. Corona.
Exactly. Thanks, Corona.
Did you like the Hugh Grant character? Like, without him, I think I wouldn't have made it through the movie awake.
I sort of liked his character, but I think that it was kind of, I don't like the way that they used him. I don't like that he was the one that was driving the plot. He's the one telling this convoluted story to Charlie Hunnam, like over, I don't know. And Charlie Hunnam basically wants to kill him. Like, I don't know. I didn't appreciate that. It was very different than I've seen Hugh Jackman or Hugh Grant. So I liked that. I appreciated that a lot, but it's just not my normal. I usually like Guy Ritchie movies a lot, except for I didn't watch the one that Madonna was in, but
sure. No one did.
But, right. I don't even think Guy Ritchie watched it, but yeah, like Lock, Stock and Snatch. And I know a lot of people are like, those are the same movies. I mean, but it's a formula that he does well. And like King Arthur, Sherlock Holmes, like, that's what I like. I enjoyed that. And this was nothing like it. This was so slow. Again, just basically, I would just leave it alone.
Well, while we're on specifically the movies that are on theatrical on demand Corona special, since we're all covering one of those this week, Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always is an
abortion road trip movie.
An abortion road trip movie. So look, again, the standard COVID warning. Not going to like brighten your day. This is probably the best new movie I've seen since the shutdown began.
Really?
Written and directed by Eliza Hittman, who is one of those filmmakers that, you know, she's done some things before now, but immediately I'm like, oh, this person is an amazing, amazing filmmaker. You know, it's a pretty stock story. It's a young girl, you know, who gets pregnant and can't go to her parents and has to deal with that. But the two things that made it very distinct for me, the main character is not a plucky movie heroine. She's a kind of shitty teenager. Like, you know, you like her and you feel for her, but like, she's a jerk.
She's no Juno.
Right, right. And there is no, like, there is not a single big speech in this entire movie. Like, she doesn't, like, break down and say what she's feeling. She doesn't explain how she got here. She doesn't, like, send a message out. She doesn't really say much. And, like, and it is still a remarkably powerful, powerful movie without, you know, all of the shortcuts you take to making a movie powerful. And a first-time actress as well. Her name is Sydney Flanagan. Let's draw, hopefully not, a bad movie.
All right.
See what's coming next. As a reminder, Robin has two vetoes. The rest of us have none. The number is 945 on the big list. How does everyone feel about a date with Satan right now in the middle of our quarantine? The draw is The Right from 2011.
That was Anthony Hopkins?
It's an Anthony Hopkins possession movie.
Is it any good?
I saw it. I don't recall it being, I don't have really much memory of it.
I'm feeling a veto coming unless somebody stops me.
I don't think it was good. Like, there are possession movies that are not good, but are still interesting. Like Exorcism of Emily Rose or The Last Exorcism. This was one where I was like, I felt icky Satan feelings and it was a waste of time.
Okay, it's 21% on the tomato meter. I'm going to veto it.
We have a veto, lady.
I feel lousy with vetoes and now I'm back to a normal number of vetoes.
Like, look at me, yeah, I got vetoes coming out of my ass.
Exactly that.
It should be noted that, I mean, Robin has an extra one, but like by our, we exhausted our year's supply of vetoes on April 7th.
Yes.
I would not have used my one and only veto to stop us from watching this movie, but when I have an extra one to burn, I don't want to watch this. And it's not available for free anywhere. I'm just like, okay, veto.
I drew the other one.
Oh no, did I make it worse? Oh,
I don't think you made it worse. I don't think you made it worse. It's just that everyone remembers the rules. There can't be two vetoes. The next thing we have
to watch.
I totally
forgot to make sure that Tony was here and present for this.
Well, his absence is being felt because this is the most pointless veto of all time because we're staying in religious horror. The new draw is Stigmata from 1999.
Hi. Well, that one's good.
Is it set in Pittsburgh?
Set in Pittsburgh.
That's a good one.
It's like I've never seen it. It's good.
Yeah. I remember liking it.
It's worth watching.
Yeah. I think it's better than The Right. I'm pretty sure of that.
Get excited for how long the Pittsburgh set subway scene lasts.
If it's more than 3 minutes, it's longer than the length of the Pittsburgh subway.
They did not account for that.
Interesting that Satan is with us today. That we drew the devil and we said no, and he said no. Which, by the way,
which we were like, not today, Satan. He's like, that's where you're wrong.
Today.
Stigmata is next up on the show. Before we leave you. Teachers, again, came out in October of 1984, October 5th, to be specific. What was the number one song in America on October 5th, 1984?
Like a Virgin?
No, you're just early. Like a Virgin took over in December of that year.
Oh, okay. The
Prince?
It is Prince.
All right, let's do this.
Let's go crazy.
When Doves Cry.
Robin had it. It's Let's Go Crazy.
That's my favorite Prince song.
When Doves Cry was the number one song of the year. I just to be obstinate, I could never take the place of Your Man as my favorite Prince song. Like, not really, but like if I want to be a jerk about it, I'm like, this is an underrated Prince track.
And wait, sure.
Which song? What, When I Was Your Man? What is it?
I could never take the place of Your Man.
When You Were Mine is what I'm thinking of.
I mean, it's Prince. There are eight songs that have that title with the words shuffled a little bit.
Yeah.
Right. And a numeral shoved in there as well.
Thank you. Yep.